Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. I'm your host, Liz Busby. I'm a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a reviewer of books, and a Latter-day Saint. And with me today is my co-host, Carl.
Hello, everyone. Good to be back. My name is Carl Cranny. I have a PhD in religion, and I like to write on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture.
And we have two guests with us today. Our first guest is Jeffrey. Will you introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Jeffrey Thane. I love science fiction and fantasy. I live and breathe this stuff. I also teach at BYU Idaho. I teach psychology. That is where my heart and passion lies when it comes to academic interests.
Awesome. And our second guest is Alan. Introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm Alan Hurst. I'm a Utah dad and a lawyer and a recovering academic. I am a chronic overthinker of all the media I consume, partially because I don't actually consume that much media, and therefore I have lots of time to overthink it.
Well, you will fit in at this podcast really well, because overthinking media is what we do. Today, we're going to be overthinking a little show you may have heard of, Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power, the Amazon Prime adaptation of Tolkien's Second Age mythology. J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay are the showrunners for this show, and the show sets records for the highest per episode budget ever for a series, and it shows. But first, we're going to do our best book segment, where we each recommend one thing we are watching, reading, or listening to. My recommendation today is a series called Miss Marvel on Disney Plus. Miss Marvel started at the same time as She-Hulk, and I had initially picked She-Hulk to watch over it, and I regret that decision. She-Hulk was okay, but I made my way back to Miss Marvel, and I really enjoyed it. The first episode kind of feels just like your typical teenage superhero origin story, but the second episode is where it really got me, because it really delves into Miss Marvel's Muslim community and their interactions with the rest of American culture. It's just a fabulous example of how to do real world religion well in a sci-fi fantasy show. And it brings in elements of Muslim folklore, and it's super interesting. So I can highly recommend you watch Miss Marvel on Disney Plus. Carl, what have you got for us today?
So also on Disney Plus, I'm going to talk a little bit about their Willow show. When the first trailers came out for Willow a couple of months ago, I was surprised by how invested I became in the project just by watching the trailers. I really liked the idea that Willow, who was this little Nelwyn, random farmer, ends up becoming the Yoda character, right? The person who is now the mentor to the new generation of heroes moving forward. And I loved the idea that the original 1980s movie sort of serves as an origin story to this really powerful sorcerer. And that was really awesome to me. And then I watched the show, and I have to say, so far, not so good. I don't recommend it. For those of you sensitive to such things, there's a lesbian kiss about 10 minutes into the first episode. The princess and one of her knights are a couple, and the first episode felt like it belonged more on the CW to me, sort of a teenage angst story more than high fantasy, and I got to the point yesterday where I had to turn it off because there was a big sword fight scene coming up, and even though I had all the lights off and all the blinds drawn, I could not see what was happening on the TV. I think we all know that movies are getting darker and darker and darker. And there was actually a Vox YouTube video about this. I'm really disappointed in the show so far, so it's kind of a non-recommendation. For me, I'm going to finish it because it's still holding up on nostalgia, and having read a couple of reviews, they say the second half of the series is much better than the first half, but I have to say I'm severely disappointed so far in Willow, even though I really, really personally want this show to succeed. It ain't doing it for me yet.
Jeffrey, what have you got for us?
Yeah, absolutely. We wrapped up the first season of Star Trek Strange New Worlds, and I know you guys did a whole episode on this, so I'm not going to dwell on it too much, but just once again, I want to recommend that for any Star Trek fans out there, this show will scratch your itch in a way that none of the new Star Trek has done in the past 15 years. It is a tremendous return to classic Star Trek storytelling, flaws and all, so to speak. I could easily see this show, every episode, script exactly as it's being filmed in The Next Generation or the original series. So that kind of what makes it stand out for me as a show is it hits that nostalgia factor, but then remarkably kind of improves upon it in a way that, say, Willow isn't for you, Carl.
Yeah, it's nice when it does play still in the Star Trek universe, because that was always my complaint about the new Star Trek movies, is they don't feel Star Trek. They just feel like generic sci-fi. But it's doing its own thing, which is good too. We definitely enjoyed that show on this podcast. Alan, what have you got to recommend to us?
I am still basking in the glow of Andor, the Star Wars show that I am not sure I've ever seen a better television series, honestly, in terms of the attention to character, the attention to detail, the well-planned out plotting, and the underlying sort of political and character themes. It's just, I am astonished, and I am looking forward to watching it again. I took a break from it, in fact, to finish Rings of Power, which I did not like so much, just so that I could join you guys this morning.
On to our main discussion about Rings of Power. Speaking of good-looking series, I think we can all see the money that went into this show. Just every shot in this show is extremely good-looking. It's a far cry from the animated Lord of the Rings of my childhood with its jittery frame rate. It is just really fantastic and beautiful-looking. What are you guys' initial thoughts on the show?
For me, obviously, a show like this tries to compare itself to, and although it's not directly related to, the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings movies and the Peter Jackson Hobbit trilogy, New Line Cinema was involved in the creation of this show. Sort of the aesthetics of the show are clearly, even though they're not directly linked in a production way with these previous things, they're clearly trying to rhyme or echo these movies that came out about a generation ago. And I have to say, for myself, Lord of the Rings, the trilogy, is sort of the top form of this. The Hobbit is the bottom, and this one fits in between those two. It never quite, at least in this season, reaches the heights of the Lord of the Rings movies, but certainly doesn't sink to some of the depths of the Hobbit movies, and I'm giving myself away a little bit there. I would love to live in the parallel timeline where Guillermo del Toro got to make his two Hobbit movies instead of Peter Jackson taking over the project again and turning it into a trilogy that was basically fan fiction for his Lord of the Rings trilogy. But that's where I put it, sort of in between the three. It looks gorgeous. I'm sure we're going to get into some of the missteps, but I enjoyed it for the most part.
I don't know where I would rank it compared to the Hobbit movies, just because I think that some sort of like psychological self-protection mechanism has blocked them out of my memory. I remember they were awful. I can't compare this with those. I've repressed it.
I'll chime in here. I'll say that on far as the ranking in The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, I would agree with you, Carl. I would put Lord of the Rings at the top. I would say there are some aspects of Rings of Power that I do think are even better than some of the original Lord of the Rings. Other aspects are several notches down the ladder, right? For myself, I actually really liked Rings of Power. I agree with many of the critics on some of the missteps, but for what I loved in the show, I loved so much that I just wanted to succeed. And for that reason, I found myself a little bit defensive of the show, even when I don't need to be. In part because I just loved it. I feel like I resonated with the writers of the show and what they were trying to do, even if they didn't always land it well, if that makes sense. So that's my first take.
Yeah, I've been making my way through the Lord of the Rings books this fall. I actually am a bad fantasy fan and have never read Lord of the Rings. So I'm trying to correct that right now. And it's been interesting reading them for the first time at the same time as I'm watching Rings of Power, because the mythology and the lore that I bounced off before, now it means something, because watching Rings of Power, I'm like, oh, I know what Numenor is. Oh, I get Isildur. Like, I have something to connect it to, so it actually made it easier for me to read Lord of the Rings, which was an interesting experience.
Yeah, for me, going into Rings of Power, I had never read the Silmarillion before, and I know that Rings of Power isn't the Silmarillion, because they actually only bought the rights to the appendices, some of which overlaps the Silmarillion, some of which doesn't. And I mentioned this on a previous episode, where I watched the first, like, 5 minutes of the show, and when I saw those two huge trees, one of them is gold, and one of them is sort of a silvery thing, I was like, what are those? And I paused it and stopped and went back and read the Silmarillion, just so I could then hit play and start over again and finish it. And I really enjoyed having that more complete background for the show. but it was interesting to me to have that experience of like, I don't know what those are. I should know what those are. I'm going to pause this, read an entire book, and then hit play.
Well, I thought an interesting way to go over the show might be to do a little buy or sell on the various plot lines, because there's a lot happening in the show. I think maybe one of the flaws is that it's trying to do way too much in one season of only, what, 8 episodes? So I thought we might go through each plot line and kind of talk a little bit about it. So the main character, arguably, of the series is Galadriel. I personally really liked this portrayal of Galadriel, and I'm interested to see her transformation into the Galadriel that we know from the Peter Jackson movies. So I buy Galadriel's characterization. I appreciated her as a brash hero who we find out maybe this brashness and this persistence is not a positive quality, whereas in most fantasy, the female character who's just out there to fight things and kill stuff is the hero, and this is a good, positive thing. In this case, it's being a negative thing and showing the negative aspects of just being really persistent and ignoring everyone else's advice.
So I'm going to have lots of negative things to say, and I don't want to bring up the rear on everything because I don't want this to be like me trashing a show everybody enjoys and ruining people's enjoyment of something they think is genuinely good. And I just don't want to throw all my criticisms out there because I'm not sure how edifying that would be to everybody. But, and actually a little bit more prologue for you here. I'm going to do my 10-minute monologue. When I make criticism here, I want to be clear about two things I am not doing. One of them is I am not comparing the show to the Tolkien writings and saying anytime it diverges, that's a problem, because that's not my attitude. That's a silly way to approach any sort of screen adaptation because you just got to change stuff. Now, departures from what I consider to be the animating spirit of Tolkien's work, those I can complain about. In the old Legendarium stuff, I don't think Tolkien had all that really exactly worked out, right? He wrote these ancient stories, some of them multiple times. He wrote them multiple ways. He changed his mind over the course of his life as to how various things went down. So there's not actually a Bible here, and I'm not going to ding the show for departing from one. So that's my first thing I'm not doing. And the second thing I'm not doing is I know there's been a lot of complaints about this show from the right saying that this is wokeism, this is woke Lord of the Rings, and I don't see it, right? That's not what I'm concerned about, and I don't think that it's that accurate a criticism. So with that prologue out of the way, I don't like Galadriel. And it's not that I don't like her because she doesn't fit my notions as to gender stereotypes, though this is clearly a show with modern gender relations by and large, and that is distracting for me. But mostly I don't like her because I feel like, one, I find her unwatchable, just really unpleasant on the screen, and two, I don't think they've earned most of the emotional stuff they're putting her through, right? I don't think they've earned her efforts at epic titanic rage toward the orcs early on just fall totally flat because they haven't built the context around them to make them work. As the show goes on, I can see some improvement, and I see that maybe in future seasons I will start to like this character. But as far as the first season, I see what they're trying to do. I think they didn't pull it off.
I'll chime in here. I actually really did like her character as an actor. I think she's perfectly cast, except for size and height and all that kind of stuff. Like, Galadriel's supposed to be tall, and she's not. Like, I get all that. I agree with those criticisms. But as far as the acting, the actor's done a stellar job portraying this character. I would agree with Alan, the writing has some issues. And part of the issues is that, first off, where I am comparing with the book, I do feel like they should have made her the mage instead of the warrior. I think they should have left behind the swordplay, and she could have still been that aggressive, obstinate, all that kind of stuff if they wanted to make her that way. But they could have at least, at the very least, had her fight her battles through trickery and cunning rather than through swordplay. That leave that for other characters rather than making her the master of all trades. I do like the fact, though, that we have a launching pad for a Galadriel who can change throughout the show. And I do sometimes get impatient with some of the critics who are like, but the Galadriel of the books is wise and generous, and that's not this Galadriel. And I actually like that because I don't think we should land or start the character where the character is supposed to land. I think good storytelling will give us room to breathe and room to grow. But I do agree with Alan that the character as is, I don't like. I just expect to eventually like her as she becomes that character.
I'm going to have to agree with Jeff and Liz a little bit more. I like that we have this character who I don't know that we need to earn that she is rage-filled against the orcs and Morgoth and Sauron and all the servants of evil. We just kind of start with her in this crusader mode, and I think it works. It is not Morfydd Clark's fault that she is discount Kate Blanchett. I thought she did a marvelous job. And again, aside from not being 6 foot three, it's a fantastic casting. And I buy the evil that we see brooding in her. The scene when she's talking with Adar and he kind of snickers at her and says, "Oh, if you're looking for servants of Sauron, you shouldn't have looked any further than your own mirror." I think that hit her. And I hope, and it seems to me that they're setting up over the course of the 5-season arc they sort of have planned. It's obvious that they're setting her up to be this crusader at the beginning. And then by the end of season 5, there'll be more of the Galadriel from the more detailed portions of the books. And of course, the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit movies. But I like that she is so zealous in her cause that she ends up causing half of the problems that she then has to fix. Like that... that makes sense to me, and that is a good way of characterizing why this particular mindset is not a good one, and we can hope to watch her move out of it. Maybe a being that's thousands of years old should have already learned these lessons, but they can happen on screen for us, and that's fine.
Sure. And I'll throw in the aside, that's one of my issues, is to me this character is not plausibly thousands of years old, right? It's just like, this is not the way 85-year-olds act, say nothing of 2,000 85-year-olds.
Although, can I jump in real quick and say, sure. If you had been hunting orcs for hundreds of years, maybe you would be more of a Sith Lord and filled with rage and anger? I don't know. So there's a couple of ways that could go.
Sure. They expressly say that she's going to end up causing, or did end up causing, the outcomes that she was trying to prevent. And yet, as I think back, did she? Certainly her tragic flaws didn't cause the bad outcomes, right? If she just hadn't done anything, Mount Doom would still have erupted, the Southlands would still be Mordor, maybe Sauron would still be floating around on a raft in the ocean somewhere, but Sauron, he can get out of that, right? This is not actually a problem for him. If you're going to do a proper tragedy, you want your tragic fatal flaw to cause the bad outcome, to cause the tragedy that befalls your character, right? I don't think hers did.
It definitely could be stronger that it was caused by her. The show seems to be trying to imply that Sauron Halbrand would have just hung out and not done anything if Galadriel hadn't been there, which I don't know if that's believable for Sauron, that he's not scheming to get back there to do something. Okay, let's talk about the plot line with the Southlanders and Arondir and Bronwyn. I felt really mixed about them. How did you guys feel about the portrayal of the human community in the Southlands?
I had mixed feelings as well, but I will say I do think it was an improvement on Lord of the Rings in some respect, and here's why. I feel like when I watch the Lord of the Rings movies, I see these huge like stone fortresses in the mountains and the huge stone city of Gondor. And so I did feel like in some respect, the Southlands gave us an actual human community rather than stone walls populated by people in dressed in gray linens walking around with literally nothing to do.
Yeah, I think Tolkien is definitely a great man theory of history kind of person. He doesn't think a ton about the logistics of how the community works.
So part of what we're talking about here is a genre thing, all right? So The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings are different genres. In The Hobbit, there's this extended discussion of how this whole economy works, of goods come from the south and up the river, and they go to the lake, and then they go down the lake to the elves, and here are the people involved, and they're the barrel men, and here are like the pain points of, you know, well, the king's going to be mad if you throw his full wine casks back in the water to float back to up the supply chain, right? So he does this in The Hobbit. And why does he do this in The Hobbit? Because The Hobbit is an adventure story. It's a travel story. It's Bilbo is going through these new countries and he is discovering new things and we're getting acquainted with the world as we go. But it's like, this is there, right? And the petty town politics of Lake Town are there a little bit. They're just hinted at. There's not a ton of them. But like he talks about the master of Lake Town and why he's elected and all these things. So Tolkien was perfectly aware of all these questions and he intentionally leaves them out of The Lord of the Rings. Why? Because they are not fit subject matter for an epic. And I rewatched Star Wars Episode 1 at some point in the last years. It starts out and already in the opening crawl in the first scene with a couple of Jedi, they're talking about trade negotiations. And let me submit to you that if you are trying to make an epic and your characters are talking about trade negotiations in your opening pages, you need to step away from the keyboard because something has gone badly wrong. And Tolkien left this stuff out on purpose.
Okay, I'll concede to you to some degree there. I just, for me, like when it comes to making the world feel lived in, you don't even have to say a word of a dialogue about it. Just show it. And so for me, that's kind of what it's really about. The Southlanders at least very showed the human aspect of it. And that's what I liked.
The thing that I liked about it was what you're saying here, Jeff, that it shows the effects of all of these things. Instead of dealing with kings and queens and lost heirs, the mayors of Lake Town and lost dwarven thanes in exile, you're dealing with the farmers on the ground and seeing how things affected them. The thing that I found the most compelling about this was the sort of subplot line of Waldreg, who is sort of still a Morgoth and Sauron believer, sort of the throwback to these people who fought on the side of Morgoth in the last war. I think it's interesting to sort of see the point of view of the elves who are like, man, you guys were fighting for Morgoth 1,000 years ago. We don't trust you. And the humans are like, 1,000 years ago? What? Why would you care about what happened 1,000 years ago? And you get a hint of the different worldviews of these semi-divine immortal beings and then these mortal men doomed to die. And so I liked that there was sort of some tension in the human community with this one guy who then, when confronted with the actual reality of the evil he thinks he's been worshiping, he still follows through on stuff, but there's like a scene where Adar wants him to murder Bronwyn's kid, and I enjoyed that. What I didn't enjoy was the romance between the elven warrior and the human farmer, because this is like a thing that's only happened twice in all of Middle-earth history, the sort of the half-elf scenario, and it should be incredibly rare, and when it does, they have to like literally petition the gods to even have children in the mythology. And so I was like, we don't need that. And so I felt that fell flat.
I'll agree with you on both those points, Carl. I think that the strongest aspect is that, especially that opening sequence where we see the different perspective of the elves who are watching over them and the humans feeling resentful that they have to be watched over, really made me understand the difference between the two of them. And I don't know if it's followed up on as strongly as it could be, because we get distracted with the whole orcs are coming to kill us plot line, and we don't do a lot after the first two episodes with the resentment that's built up between the humans and the elves.
I would say that it is followed up, maybe not the resentment part, but the fact that the elves are watching them are like, we don't trust you. And then half of the humans follow Waldreg to go back to the orcs when they show.
Yes, so they prove to be justified, for sure. But then the humans, the other humans who aren't following it, don't react to that and be like, oh, I guess the elves were right about us. Like, that kind of thing.
Sure.
Yeah. But I also agree about the romance, that it was just like, would this have been just as strong of a plot line if he's just someone who's sympathetic to the humans and decides to help them out? Probably.
I agree with all that. The romance was probably one of the weaker parts of the show. It didn't bother me because I liked the characters. They seemed to have chemistry. It just felt like checking a box. Oh, if you're going to do a Tolkien story, you need to have an elf-human romance. And that sort of box checking, I say sell. Let's sell that.
Yeah,
absolutely sell that.
Well, speaking of elves and outsiders, let's move on to the Elrond, Durin, Mithril plotline. I personally think this is one of the best of the show.
How about I start with stuff I liked here, right? Because I agree. I think Elrond and Durin is the best part of the show. I think that their relationship is the best developed, that they have a realistic friendship here, that the actors play well. And certainly they were the only part of the show that made me laugh on a few occasions, like cracked me up. When it dawns on Elrond that, wait, that whole bit about this fancy sacred rock that you're eating dinner on is totally BS. He just wanted to take the rock and to tweak Gil-galad. Right? That was clever. I liked that a lot. And there were lots of moments like that where it's like those two work together really quite well.
Especially when he's, oh, you haven't come to visit me in 20 years. I have gotten married and had 2 kids. Where the heck were you, friend? And the elf's, oh, that was just yesterday. 20 years ago is like nothing. It's again, this good characterization of the elves thinking in a very different way.
Well, only slightly dissent from you there. I agree that kind of thing would totally happen. But what I didn't like about the way it was handled and about the way lots of things in this arc were handled is that lots of things that would have been just completely obvious and assumed to the people from the cultures are like elaborately laid out for the audience in these fairly clunky ways. And maybe the worst example is, you know, Durin the Third, Durin's dad, right? It's every time the man is on screen, his appearance on screen starts out with some long exposition of, people that the kings of old. Oh, please. Like, this is the prince of the dwarves you are talking to. Do you think he doesn't already know what is said among your people about the ancient kings of the dwarves? This is entirely for the audience's benefit. Totally implausible. And I felt like there were lots of things in this that were like that. And there were other world-building failures, too, here. Elrond sitting down with Durin's family for dinner was a great scene in lots of ways. I liked it a lot. I liked the characters and everything. But the level of cultural difference, to me, felt pretty similar to when I went to a Jewish friend's Passover Seder during law school, right? Where it's the dwarves, oh, these are our beliefs, and these are our customs. And here, let me introduce you to this sort of thing. But here's the thing about that Passover Seder I went to, right? It was a law school friend, right? We were both Americans in our 20s attending a law school, and we were all human, right? Like, the level of difference between me and my Jewish friends is not remotely the level of difference between elves and dwarves. And I felt like, you know, maybe you can't really show that level of difference. Maybe you can't actually play that out on screen the way that Tolkien can in text, where he can leave lots of things implied, unsaid, mysterious, and get the job done that way. But still, I was, y'all are still really 21st century Americans. Sorry, not buying it.
I can totally see what you're saying, Alan. And I would say that, like, ultimately, you're right. If you really wanted to play this straight and really show this, as the audience watches an elf in council, we should be wondering what's going on. It should be seen foreign and mysterious to us. That some of their customs and objections should just seem odd to us. And when we see Elrond going to visit with the dwarves, we should be a little bit, what am I supposed to expect from this? Like, what am I supposed to do something here? Like, it'd be almost like there should be some level of mystery if you're really going to showcase these immense cultural differences. The challenge is that I don't know that you can portray that on screen on a show where you need the viewers to be invested in the characters and understanding the nuances of the story and so forth. And yeah, I get what you're saying. I'm just not sure it's possible.
Sure. Yeah, you make good points there. And let me just close out what I was saying by saying again, I thought that these characters' dialogue was the best in the show, and I thought the acting was some of the best in the show. I genuinely enjoyed watching Elrond and Durin in a way that I did not generally enjoy a lot of the rest of it.
This is an Elrond who I totally believe would invite Bilbo to come and visit every summer and be delighted when he shows up.
He's very interesting as an elf, right? He's different, and you get a lot more insight into a personality of him, I feel like, without him seeming unelfish.
That's because he's Elrond half-elven. He's supposed to be a bit of an outsider, which is one of the things I thought they did, not explicitly, but if you're paying attention to it, he feels like a fish out of water in some serious ways among the elves. And I think that helps him have this relationship with Durin and the dwarves in general. And that was very subtle.
I think one of the storytelling errors of the show generally is that they don't have enough normal people running around, right? Like, we've got way too much of the great and mighty on screen. If you look at the way Tolkien does both of his big books, right? Both The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, start in a stylized 19th century England with stylized 19th century English gentlemen and common people. And you take, in the case of The Hobbit, just one of the gentlemen. And in the case of Lord of the Rings, here are three of the gentlemen and one of the common people, right? And you take these closer to us, more real worldly characters, and you walk them through the high and mighty and fantastic scenarios. And by showing you how these ordinary people respond to those situations, Tolkien can show you how you should respond to these situations. And this show doesn't do that.
I'm going to give him more of a pass on that merely because, and I don't know if this is a flaw or a strength of the show, but again, because it's rhyming and echoing so much with the previous movies, it assumes that you're culturally familiar with some of this stuff, so they don't have to spend as much time bringing the audience along the way Tolkien does in his book. So I don't know. I give them a pass on that.
It's not just like cultural fluency, right? It's establishing a scale of the persons and things involved. If they are not big for the people on the screen, they're not going to be big for the viewer. Beautiful moment, the first Lord of the Rings movie, where Frodo and the rest of the fellowship walk into the great dwarven city of Dwarrodelph, and the music swells and the lights go big, and you're able to realize, holy cow, this place is amazing. None of us have ever seen a thing like this before. You get that scope moment in part because this is huge and different for the characters. And because we don't have characters on screen for whom this is huge and different, the emotional weight is harder to convey.
I want to add a quick thought to this. I totally see what you're saying, Alan. Like, even so, for example, when like the Hobbit characters meet worldly kings, like for example, when Pippin meets the Steward of Gondor, like the way they interact shows you that this is a king. This is somebody you swear fealty to. This is a big deal, right? But you're right. In Rings of Power, when you meet the king, he just, there's nothing to compare it to down low, if that makes sense. I will say about going back to Durin and Elrond, people have complained that Rings of Power has bad writing. I agree with some of their critiques. I think that the Elrond and Durin shows that there are good writers here. Not everything that lands well, but there is a quality in the writing of their friendship and relationship and the dialogue that just shows that there is talent there that you can't ignore. And going back to this idea that Elrond half-elf and being an outsider, that came through and without any dialogue to support it, really. You just saw this and the way it was written. And so I honestly think that this, I agree, this was the best part of the show.
I think also, whether you buy the elves need the Mithril to save the elvenkind, but it does present an interesting moral quandary. Once you set aside your belief or disbelief of that, of how much do the dwarves owe the elves if they are able to save the elves? Do they owe them their labor and their risk to mine the Mithril to save them? So that is an interesting moral quandary.
I'll add to that, this is actually one way where I don't feel like these are totally modern characters. I feel like if you're making these modern characters, Gil-galad would have said, oh, they're not going to give it to us. We're going to go take it from them. And guess what? He doesn't. He just says, I guess we'll die. And that's a very non-modern thing to do, almost.
Okay, just to be clear, they're not going to die. They're going to sail to the west and go join the Valar. Like, that's not the same thing. But I guess we'll just sail west and go to heaven. Okay.
There's a sense of honor there that is distinctly pre-modern, almost. Like, it, not in real life pre-modern, but in a Tolkien sense.
Almost in a Book of Mormon sense, where they make the Lamanites swear that they'll never come to battle against them again, and then they let them go because we can believe them, even though they're our enemies, right? Like that kind of sense that promises mean something, that we're not going to worry about even our enemies going back on their promises. We've still got a few plot lines left to hit. I think the other controversial part of the show was the Harfoots, the not hobbits. I liked them at first. I liked all the individual elements of the world building, but somehow they didn't mesh together. Like the idea that the hobbits are just trying to fly under the radar and that they are very communitarian doesn't mesh well with the idea that we're also just going to leave you behind if you become mildly inconvenient or difficult to move along. Like, how do you maintain a community on that basis that if you're inconvenient, we're just going to drop you? It doesn't go through the rest of their culture. Those two elements that didn't seem really like they were woven together for me.
I agree 100%. To me, the fact that they have an entire song about nobody getting left behind, and then they like, oh, except in this scenario where we're going to leave you behind to die.
Oh, but we'll say your names at the fireside some later, right?
Remember. We'll feel bad about it.
Yeah. Oh, if they had just cut that out, the entire Harfoot thing would have worked so much better. And I hope they quietly just drop it in seasons 2 through 5, because that doesn't need to be there. Aside from that, I liked a lot of the Harfoot's plotline. The Stranger was interesting to me. I like that we're getting hints of the men to the east and things that are hinted at in Tolkien but never fully explored. And I thought the actor who portrays the Stranger did a really good job. I think it's Gandalf. That hint at the end where it's like, oh, always follow your nose. Again, resonance with the movies. You have to be culturally familiar with that to get that reference. And I thought he did a great job of being Discount Ian McKellen. And I look forward to his future version of Gandalf, or maybe it's one of the other Istari. We don't know. But
I mean, come on, it's Gandalf.
Yeah, I wish there was more ambiguity about it, because yeah, it's obviously Gandalf, and they try to play that part for a mystery, and it doesn't quite work.
I personally wish it was Saruman, because at this point, Saruman should be a good character, and I wish they played that straight. Because like, if Gandalf's around, Saruman's around, and if Saruman's around, he's good, because he doesn't turn evil until Lord of the Rings, really. And so I wish we had that, because a young Saruman who's genuinely good and trustworthy and noble, and that would have been interesting to me.
You might get it still, right? I mean, like, there's no reason to believe this is the only Istar that's made it over. But anyway, yeah.
It's true. They might go and meet them later.
I would say, as far as the Harfoot dystopia, I kind of actually liked it. in part because I think that we're portraying a really primitive culture here. If you were to go back to ancient Israel, you'd probably think it was a dystopia in some respects. Here, the really quaint, strong-knit community following God's laws and will stone you if you step out of line. They showed this quaint community that also has some deep moral flaws. And they just played it straight. They didn't do the sort of cultural critique thing. They just said, this is what it is.
I think one of the other weak points of the show is Numenor. I felt like I was very interested in these humans, and then it just did not quite play out for me how they were different from regular humans, because especially the political rhetoric of Numenor feels very cheap and not deep. Everyone is just kind of swayed by this argument that, oh, the elves are taking our jobs. And that's like very much not why they're mad at the elves. They're not worried about a labor shortage. It's supposed to be a cultural resentment between men and elves that these guys live forever and they're closer to the gods. And it's a resentment of kind, not a resentment of resources.
No, that's exactly right. The reason the Numenoreans fall in the Silmarillion and the appendices is that so the elves, being partially divine beings, literally now the earth starts out flat and then at some point it becomes round, and the elves can still sail to heaven if they go west. The humans cannot, but they try to and are punished for their hubris by the Valar.
A very Tower of Babel-ish.
Right? It's absolutely there. It's very Tolkien. It's very Catholic. Ilúvatar made you to be mortal and gave you the gift of death. Just accept it. And I understand why humans would be like, no, I'd rather have what the elves were given by Ilúvatar. But that was completely absent from this, and I hope they pick it up. But so far, there was no even minor hint of it. That was probably the most disappointing thing to me about the entire show, was the idea that Farazan's like, oh, and we're going to go save the Southlanders, and we're going to do trade, and we're going to be the saviors. And I'm just like, that's not what happened. And to Alan's point, it doesn't have to match the mythology perfectly, but this was a moment where it did not match the spirit of Tolkien, and especially his very Catholic sensibilities about the nature of creation and finding your place in creation and things like that. And it wasn't there. And this was a moment where the showrunners, I think, completely botched it. Even though I kind of liked a lot of the characters individually, but just that the absence of that major flaw in the Numenorean society made me very unhappy.
I mean, This might be a good point for me to bring up my issues with the world building, honestly, because I think that the world building failures are most obvious in Numenor, or most severe in Numenor, maybe is the way to put it. I'll add there on the world building issue. This is not plausibly a small 100-person tribe of nomads, right? They don't act like a small 100-person tribe of nomads. Like I initially took issue with some of their hobbity names of like, why is their leader named Burrows when they don't yet live in Burrows? Burrows is a hobbit name. If you're not living in holes, why is your last name Burrows? Or Brandyfoot, right? The name Brandyfoot implies the existence of something called brandy, which brandy is the product of a long established sedentary agricultural lifestyle with vineyards and distilleries.
I would call these names, except for that Tolkien basically, like, he's like that, right? Like, words matter to Tolkien. And so in any other mythos, I'd be like, eh, whatever. But in Tolkien, like, this is a major misstep.
Yes. And it was like, I was complaining about the last names to myself. And then at some point I realized, they're a 100-person tribe of nomads. They shouldn't have last names at all. But anyway, so
there you go. You're right.
Are there other Harfoot tribes around? This is an interesting idea. Like, where?
Yeah, there must be somewhere.
Who are they marrying?
Yeah.
And not becoming super inbred. Maybe hobbits are really inbred. I don't know.
They're certainly not inbred on screen, right? Because they're a United Colors of Benetton ad. Like everything is, right? Like, they've decided to just do like racially mixed casting across all cultures and ethnicities, which is, it's fine. Like, you can do this, right? I'm not one of those who demands that all of this be white people, but Ross Douthat in New York Times, I thought, had a really great take on it, which is, look, if you want a diverse cast and verisimilitude, what you need is still recognizable ethnic groups, right? And you can have the Numenoreans be like ancient Egyptians, look Near Eastern or something. And you can have some of the tribes of, there are various tribes of elves, and you could have one of them be Ethiopian, another one be South Asian or something, right? You can do this, but they still need to look like tribes. And in this, obviously, they don't. Like, it's plain that these are just actors that have been brought together to play something.
And I think that's just like a product of our time, right? Like, after 2020, we've just gone the way of we need to do race blind casting. We need to just cast actors for the part. And it does hurt the verisimilitude somewhat in terms of trying to create a world that is not yet cosmopolitan like ours, where races would be mixing.
This is a point where they also couldn't win either, because
no, there's no way to win.
Yeah, that they played it straight, there'd be complaints the other way, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Fair.
Yeah.
Okay, but Numenor, sorry. I got on a longer sidetrack than I intended. I did intend a little sidetrack. But so Numenor.
It wouldn't be a podcast without sidetracks. That's our job.
Oh, good. I look at Numenor and it's just, this is just not, this is not a plausible society to begin with, right? Like, to me, like, from what I can tell, nothing is happening in Numenor until Galadriel and Halbrand arrive on a ship. Actually, nowhere in this show do I see society happening that is not about the plot. But in Numenor, the failure is particularly stark, because this should be a mighty island kingdom. This place should be big. This place should be noble. This place should be a serious place that takes itself seriously. And there's just none of that in evidence.
Except visually, I will say.
Visually. Okay, so they've done some pretty visuals. But even there, like, I'm not sure, it's not that big. And generally, like, none of the show seems big. Numenor feels like it might maybe be the size of my high school, right? Like, these are just small places in terms of number of people.
But, and to your point, Alan, where's their standing army? Do they have to ask for volunteers?
Yeah.
And then, and one moment in that process, right? It's like, Galadriel wants them all to try to land a hit on her, and she's training them in sword play because none of them know how to use a sword yet. And then, and it's announced, first person who scores a hit on her is going to be my lieutenant. Wait, like, you don't already have one? Like, where is the existing society that is going here? And wait, isn't your lieutenant a significant position of responsibility? It has to be somebody you trust and not just the person who happened to manage to get a sword on Galadriel?
They have a navy, but no army.
Yeah, which, yeah. I mean, that may be plausible enough in a way, right? But even the navy, right, is, it's like...
It doesn't feel particularly big and full in the way that we would hope it would. It feels a little bit amateurish in the writing, in that it has the trappings of a fantasy world without the depth that we would expect from Tolkien.
I just have to say, I completely disagree with this whole characterization. I thought that as much as I disliked that one plot line in Numenor's absence, I don't know, it felt a lot bigger to me than your high school. I don't know how big your high school was, but I bought that this was an insular city that had a good navy, but had just kind of kept itself there and was just basking in the glory of yesteryear and isn't quite sure what it wants to be moving forward. I don't know. I totally bought that. So maybe I'm in the minority here, but those parts of Numenor were fine for me.
I'll finish up my "this place seems too modern to me" thing. So the obvious glaring example is, of course, the elves going to take your job speech, right? This is just like the people did not see the world like this. Idea that most people's goal in life is to have a position of employment in which they do work for a wage from a superior, right? Like, this just ain't how the world worked. Even like a century ago, this is not how the world worked. But it goes broader than that. Like, then, like, you look at the family structures, right? Like, across the show, right? All the marriages are egalitarian between people of roughly the same age. All the families have a number of kids that would be socially acceptable in Cambridge or Brooklyn, right? Like, it's 2-3 kids tops, right? Children disobey their parents. Like, disobedience is like a live option for the kids, and nobody expects serious consequences from disobeying their parents. For comparison, think ancient Rome, which is one of the plausible models for this, right? Ancient Rome, you disobey your dad, he might kill you and be fully within his legal rights to do it. And everybody who heard about it would think, man, I'm sorry your son was so awful. And nobody would think a thing of you deciding, I'm just going to execute my son for disrespecting me. That's the way families worked once upon a time. There's no breath of that anywhere, right? And there's no breath of, like, Isildur, right, is saying, I'm not sure I want to be in the Sea Guard. And what's Elendil's response? Elendil's response is cajole or insist or look a little imposing, right? Their most history of the world, it would never have occurred to Isildur that he might possibly disobey. It would never have occurred to Isildur, or Aeorian, his sister, gets her job in the Builders Guild without her father's knowledge or involvement. No, not how the world worked. Or the fact that neither of them is married in their late 20s. Not how most places have worked in the history of the world. And then the professionalism, like the assumed meritocracy, like, here's my long spiel. Sorry, here it is. I'm getting towards the end, though. One of the points in the middle few episodes is Isildur really wants to go on this journey. And the notion is there's this meritocratic notion that he has to earn it, right? That he has to deserve to be part of this group. And there's this bit of resentment at the notion that he would get to come. Like the guy says, oh yeah, Sealer comes, his dad got him in like he always does or something like that. Like, there's this resentment that your familial connection is not an appropriate way to get your position in a military force. Are you kidding me? That's how military forces were built, right? Like through much of the world, like it would be absolutely naturally assumed. Of course Isildur is going because he is Wendell's son. He's probably going to be his lieutenant, the same way that Boromir and Faramir are the captains of Gondor because they're Denethor's kids. And nobody would think this was the least bit inappropriate, not even a little bit. It would be the natural order of things that everyone would simply assume.
Just like Moroni's kid becomes the captain of the armies. It's just expected.
It works. Like, it's just, these things are just inherited.
I buy that. I like that a lot.
And the last thing about this, like the military world building that bothers me, and this is in the elves too. Like, it's this notion of like, you have this professionalized national sea guard or the Northern armies, and soldiers are like commissioned by the king and sent out to this army or sent or accepted to the sea guard. That's the exact opposite of the way a military was built. You would be the commander of the Northern armies because you were the person who had the relationships with the local lords and with the local individuals that you could raise a Northern army. And that Northern army's loyalty would be primarily to you personally, the person who raised them as an army and the person who pays them and makes sure they're fed, and not to some like abstract kingdom or king, etc. This is how feudalism worked. This is how lots of things have worked through history. And in Numenor, it's the same way, right? Like the sea guard being like this professional institution is just not realistic to anything before like 1800.
And I think this is a common problem in science fiction and fantasy. If you're trying to portray a society different from ours, and yet you're an author who is writing in our contemporary times to an audience that's contemporary times, how much do you include a perspective that is accurately reflective of the times, but maybe repugnant to us nowadays? I'm thinking of things like, to bring it to us, a Mormon scriptural thing, Orson Scott Card's Women of Genesis series. My mom could never get into that because the Women of Genesis series has a very modern, nearly feminist perspective that these women in ancient biblical times are supposedly having. I feel like it's a constant problem to determine which kind of story you want to tell. And to be fair, Tolkien is generally on the side of writing something that feels more pre-modern. And so maybe that's why it doesn't feel right in this show to do that, but it is pretty common in science fiction and fantasy to do this kind of thing.
I want to add one quick thought to this. I'll say that one place where this show does shine on that respect is that there was not a hint of expressive individualism in the entire show, and our current culture is saturated in it. Isildur might be the only exception there, and the show did not look particularly kindly on it. So that's one place where I thought the show did eschew and just reject a modern perspective, which I was fully braced to see and be disappointed in, and I didn't see it, and I felt that was refreshing.
That's fair. I'm a little bit with Liz on this point, that I kind of agree with all of your criticisms of it being sort of modern mindsets in a very not modern, even mythological prehistory. This is like prehistory for even Lord of the Rings. So like we're way back in the timeline, but it's just, I don't know. It just didn't bother me quite as much.
We've talked a lot about the artistic aspects, but I thought maybe we should, since we like to talk about gospel themes and such, we need to get into the moral aspects of the show. I think Jeff has pointed some good things that it's all about agency in this show and making choices. So if you wanted to riff on that for a little bit for us.
Yeah, sure. I'll try to give like a 2-minute version of this. I do think that this show really highlights the theme of agency more than almost any show I've seen in recent times. And this was really driven home in the final episode where the stranger says to Nori that they showed me who I am. And Nori responds, only you can show what you are. You chewed by what you do. And at first I thought, is this expressive individualism? And I realized, no, it's not. You can choose to be good or bad. This is moral agency, not expressive individualism. And you're good or bad by the choices that you make, not by some like deep down, like inner nature that you can't change. Like you reveal your badness and your goodness in terms of the choices that you make. And that was a running theme throughout the entire show. That there's one plot element that was mere coincidence or happenstance. And that's when Galadriel and Sauron meet on the ocean. But every other development in the show was driven by the choices of the characters. Well, those choices are, they're all over the story. You have Durin choosing to forgive Elrond. You have Alindo's choice to rescue Halbrand and Galadriel instead of leaving him on the sea when that was fully within his rights. You have Muriel's choice to trust Galadriel. Muriel's choice to believe in the signs from the gods. You have the choice of Isildur to neglect his duties. You have the choice of Arondir to seek out Bronwyn, and the choice of Bronwyn to refuse to cave at the Adar's demands to surrender. I could go on and on. Every time the plot moves forward, it's because characters have made consequential moral choices in some way. And I found that to be quite refreshing. This is a thoroughly character-driven show. Whether you agree with all the different character arcs and the way they're developed or not, it's their choices that are driving the series. Now, you might say that some of their choices are contrived for the sake of plot. I get that. But either way, unless they made the choice they did, the plot wouldn't happen. If none of the characters chose that they did, the plot would just stand still. And I thought that was really cool.
And I have to say, I'm not sure that Sauron being out on a raft on the ocean was an accident, but maybe they'll explain more of that later, or maybe they won't, because, I don't know, man, it's Sauron. He's doing Sauron stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. They're going to have to sell to me that was a purposeful meeting, because it does seem pretty random. It's a big ocean out there.
And I would just say here, too, like, you can see the seeds of future themes of moral agency already playing out. Isildur's going to make tremendous moral choices down the road, bad ones that have lasting impact on generations to come. You're going to see the greediness of the dwarves as they mine for more mithril and then end up unleashing the Balrog. At least that's how I expect that plot to play out. You're going to see Numenor, where these characters choose to engage in treachery that leads to an eventual civil war and the fall of their society. And ultimately, I expect to see the choices of these characters lead to the downfall of every single set piece that we've seen in this story. Numenor falls, Khazad-dûm falls, Lindon falls, Eregion falls. Like, all these communities get destroyed in the end, and I presume, based on what I've seen so far, it's going to be because of the choices these characters make. And I think that's actually really cool.
I think it is very interesting to think of this, not necessarily, I guess, a tragedy, but it's a tragedy specifically that it's a tragedy that is the fall of man, right? The fall of Middle Earth. It's interesting to have a series that's based on evil is going to triumph in the end because we're going to end up in the place where Lord of the Rings starts. We have to end up with Isildur making that choice to keep the ring, with people being corrupted. I found it interesting that it starts with a voiceover that says nothing is evil in the beginning. It feels very Genesis, right? God saw that it was good, and then it's going to fall. And so it feels like a very religious worldview in that aspect of this is the story of something good being corrupted and the fall of man.
And being corrupted, not in the sense that I've been poisoned and now I'm sick, but rather I'm corrupted because I chose to indulge my temptations and my lust. And on one more theme on here, this is really driven home in episode 6, when Arondir gives Theo the artifact. Arondir sees a lust for power in Theo and knows that he will never overcome this unless Theo himself is the one who gives it up. I love this recognition that it has to be Theo's choice. Arondir could have just taken the artifact away, but he said, no, you need to go give this away. I want Theo to choose to give it up because I want Theo to be a good person, and that requires him to make a choice. And that sort of moral agency theme there, I just really loved that theme throughout the entire show.
And I think this all goes back to the characterization of Sauron / Halbrand. He was a very interesting character to me. I know, Carl, you said you rewatched it after the big reveal. Anything you noticed, anything you want to talk about with Sauron and his characterization? What kind of Satan is he?
This was the part to me that I enjoyed, I think, probably the most, is the way the actor portrays him as a little conflicted, because that's what Sauron is. And I thought they picked up on that thread and decided to run with it really well. Or I listened to an interview where he, for the first two episodes, did not know that his character was Sauron. So first two episodes, he's just playing Halbrand straight. Now that we're like an hour into this, spoilers! Halbrand is Sauron!
Wait, he won?
What?
Oh no!
And so after episode 2, you have the actor playing Sauron, playing Halbrand, and it changes a little bit. I just rewatched, like, the Galadriel Halbrand arc, because I wanted to watch this, sort of like how you go back and watch The Sixth Sense. Spoilers again, once you know that the therapist is a ghost, right? It changes the way you view the movie. And this way, the TV show, I thought that it was really good in how, like, Sauron is a deceiver. He is a person who comes to you in the thing that you want the most. And Galadriel's vengeance crusade against orcs and Sauron and all things Morgoth, he's able to tap into that by pretending to be the reluctant king of the Southlands where there are orcs. And she's like, "Ooh, I can take you. If I make you the king, we can go kill all the orcs and this will be great. I can finally achieve," like, he's just playing on her the whole time. But then at the very end, when he reveals his true motivations, which was that he wants to fix Middle Earth, right? Like, Morgoth is a nihilist. He just wants to burn it all down. But Sauron is a perfectionist. He is more of the Latter-day Saint version of Satan. Like, "I will redeem them all. Give me the glory. I'll fix everything and make it right. All you have to do is marry me and I will bind you to power and you could bind me to the light. And this will be a really good combination." And Galadriel's like, "Absolutely not." Horrified at how she has been led along by this character the entire time. And although I didn't get major hints of the Sauron-ness until that very last episode or two, when he's there helping him make the rings, and there's that great scene that's like out of a horror movie where Celebrimbor comes into his workshop. He's like, "Hello, is there someone there? Show yourself." And I'm like, that's a horror movie trope where you walk in, you're like, "Hello, is someone there?" And then the monster jumps out, except that it's just Halbrand sitting there. It's like, oh, That was like my first major hint that he was Sauron. I'm like, they put him as a horror movie monster just for that 30-second scene. I liked the Sauron Satan because he thinks he has good intentions. But in the end, when he says, "I want to fix everything," she says, "I think you mean you want to rule everything." And he says, "I see no difference." Like, he really doesn't. And that's his flaw, at least in this characterization, which is very true to Tolkien's mythos in some ways. And I really liked it. And I think the actor does a brilliant job. And that scene at the very end where he's walking into Mordor and he's looking a little more serious, a little more dark, I'm like, oh, he's totally selling me that he was Sauron playing Halbrand. And now he's playing Sauron.
I have two thoughts to follow up on this. I do think that reveal scene with Galadriel is one of the best on-screen satanic archetypes I've ever seen. In part because of how subtle and crafty he was, attacking every possible angle of persuasion and doing so in such a way that you could plausibly see Galadriel being tempted by this. And I think that we forget that the adversary isn't just a sort of dark, hideous presence that you immediately know is evil the moment you see him. He shows up in our culture, in our lives, everywhere. And we don't even realize he's there, planting thoughts in our minds that we think are our own. And that's exactly what we see in Sauron. One critique here is that we should have seen that going on more. Maybe more Galadriel's thinking was planted by Sauron all along. We didn't really see that played out, and I think we should have seen that a little bit more. But we did see it play out with Celebrimbor, where Celebrimbor speaking words that clearly came from Sauron, but he doesn't even realize that they weren't his own. And I thought that was really cool. And also, I have a Catholic friend who complained about this whole depiction because he said, "Sauron seemed petulant, and evil isn't petulant." And I'm like, well, I'm a Latter-day Saint, and we have some additional scripture in which Satan is petulant. And I loved it for that reason. The one weakness with this entire storyline is that there is not a single page in Tolkien's work that I would say belongs to the mystery genre. Like, even in The Hobbit, like, where does Smaug go? We don't know. It's a mystery. Turn the page and Tolkien tells you. Tolkien doesn't do mystery, but the genre of this show was high fantasy in a sense, but also mystery. What's the meaning of this? What's the meaning of that? Who is Sauron?
And I think the who is Sauron, like, setting that up as the problem of this season is what led to the Sauron being a little less Sauron-y in the early episodes, because they couldn't play their hand too early because that's what they were trying to set up. It would have, I think, been more interesting if they had not set that up as a mystery and allowed Sauron to manipulate Galadriel a little more.
Imagine the suspense if the entire season you were saying, "Don't believe him, don't believe it. Oh, you believed him. No." You know, imagine that ongoing suspense. And if they just played it straight. And honestly, it would have been truer to the spirit of Tolkien if you didn't have this mystery box storytelling. The payoffs didn't quite work. I loved the Sauron Halbrand stuff, but I think it would have been even better if we just always knew he was Sauron. So,
yeah, it definitely would work better with the archetype of the Fall, which is where this story is going. Just like seeing people make these choices that you know are wrong, the tragedy element would have been stronger.
I agree 100%. It would have been interesting if you knew he was the snake in the garden to begin with. And you knew, like, watch that character. We got issues.
To watch him knowing he was evil. Imagine if we knew that he was Sauron and we see him manipulating the guilds of Numenor. And by the end of the season, we see the work he has done already taking root and corrupting the people's hearts. And so therefore you end up this pregnant note of suspense. Oh, goodness, he's already planted seeds of evil in Numenor. Now he's planting seeds of evil among the Southlanders. Now you see his work throughout the season. Imagine how much more intense these storylines would have been.
I mean, you make good points. And I'll say that I liked episode 8 better than anything in the previous 7. I thought it was hands down the best episode. You make good points about the agency, about the significance of choosing between good and evil. And you picked up on stuff there that I didn't. And I'm glad to hear about it and glad to see it. I think that where they are not true to Tolkien's vision and should have been truer and could have been better if they were truer is it has to do with the world building, the modernity stuff that I was talking about earlier, right? Because if you want to understand the moral philosophical message of like real Tolkien, the first thing you need to understand is this guy was anti-modern, like deeply, profoundly anti-modern, right? This is a guy who loved the English countryside, hated industrialization, hated the smoke in the air, the trees being cut down, etc., hated modern political organizations, hated modern war above all else. People probably know that this guy fought at the Battle of the Somme in World War I. He hated modernity. He came by his hatred of modernity very honestly, and he poured it into these books. And what did Tolkien see? What is to Tolkien the nature of modernity? I think it would boil down to two things, the love of technology and the fear slash hatred of death. So when I see Celebrimbor being basically an engineer, right, and talking about mixtures of alloys and amount of pressure, and if we have a circle, then the light can go around in a circle, and Mithril shines out light so that we elves can get enough vitamin D and don't waste away. Like, all of this stuff, the world they're portraying here, like the metaphysics of this world is effectively materialist. Whereas in Tolkien, I think a sentence to understand Tolkien magic you get from Tennyson, which is, my strength is as the strength of 10 because my heart is pure, right? The real world, that's maybe metaphor or imagination or polite fiction or something. In Tolkien, that's real. In Tolkien, the reason Aragorn is an invincible warrior is because he truly is a great soul. In Tolkien, the reason that Galadriel doing magic is her nature flowing out into the world and making the world like her, basically. So for Tolkien, the beauty of Mithril is not just an imaginary thing in the minds of people or like the right wavelength of mystical light. The beauty itself is magical, and the character of people itself has an effect on the world. And none of that's present here, right? And this, the rings are like, I thought the forging scene of the three rings was really cool, actually. I enjoyed watching it. Throughout, I'm like, where's the actual magic here? These guys don't know what actual magic looks like to Tolkien. These guys are doing technology. This is their last project was a Star Trek movie, and that's seeping in. This is kind of a Star Trek movie too. And then as far as the rest of modernity, the fear of death, that's not really there. Not a theme that motivates much of this. Tolkien's particular concerns as to what he thought constituted evil are a powerful message that I'm not sure I agree 100% with, but I agree with a lot of it. And certainly it is powerful. It is timely. It is interesting and unique in a way that this show's vision of good and evil just isn't. Like they don't know what good and evil is to them, I think. The last point I wanted to say is it relates to the Numenor thing. I think another way of summing up Tolkien's anti-modernity is the fall of Numenor. That Numenor is modern and is destroyed by the Valar for it. And it's at that moment when Iluvatar makes the world round. Like he does that at the moment that Numenor rebels and tries to sail to Valinor. And this, I just wanted to point out, like, the anti-modern feeling of this. Like, what is the stereotypical modern realization, like, that divides us from the ancient world in pop culture? It's, we know the world is round and not flat. In actual point of history, people have known the world was round for a very long time because they saw its shadow on the moon and an eclipse, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, most people think, right, that 800 years ago, everybody thought the world was flat. Tolkien's response to that is, yes, the world is round, and it's your fault The moral rebellion of humanity has fundamentally altered the nature of reality so that it is no longer open to the divine in the way that it used to be. That's Tolkien. And this was a deeply important thing to him personally. So we know that Numenor is destroyed when it goes under the water, right? And we know that Faramir in The Lord of the Rings mentions this, that he has this dream repeatedly of a great civilization being destroyed by a great wave. And this is actually depicted at one point in episode 3 or 4 or wherever, right, in Rings of Power. What probably fewer people know is that this dream, this recurring dream of a wave destroying a great society, is a dream that Tolkien himself had. This was a recurrent dream for him. This is the way he saw the world. This is what he thought modernity was, a wave wiping out a fundamentally good society built on Christianity that had, to his mind, previously existed. And that's the underlying plate tectonics underneath everything that happens in Lord of the Rings is right there. And of course, in Rings of Power, it's completely absent. They're just not aware of or don't care about any of this.
I think the reason they have to focus so much on the technology is that the technology is going to destroy the world, right? We have to show the forging of the Rings of Power, this technological obsession with making something, a device that can be powerful as opposed to a relationship with God or an interior power. So I think the focus on technology may be intentional. It may bring more of that into it. But I love what you've said about Tolkien's worldview. It's great.
I'll add here too, though, that I do think that, for example, one of the things that makes the rings evil and corrupting people, I may be misremembering the mythology, was in part because Sauron played a hand in making them. That the moral character of the individuals involved corrupts the process. I will point out here, just in terms of the production quality of the show, the last 7 minutes of the show has zero dialogue, and nobody notices until I get out to them. And I think that was really cool. There's a lot that happened in that last 7 minutes. The creation of the Three Rings, Elrond discovering Galadriel's secrets, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And it's all portrayed through facial expressions and editing choices and so forth. And I just want to point out that does tell me there is a quality behind the writing, quality behind the production, that you can do the final 7 minutes of a major epic series like this without any dialogue and portray multiple character developments and story developments in the process. And I thought that was really cool.
I'm going to be a little bit with Liz on the creation of the rings itself is Sauron's idea that he's slowly going to seed with everything. In the mythology, the elves make their rings independent of Sauron because they're aware of his involvement. And in this case, they did. She's like, we have to make three. Like, one corrupts, two divides. With three, there is balance. That's very true to the mythology. But this idea that they were all of them deceived, right, says Galadriel in the beginning of the Lord of the Rings movie. I'm going to help you make these rings into which you will, you know, give you the will and strength to govern the races. But actually, I'm just trying to create my version of Utopia, which is where I run the whole show. And so there's an element of technology and using things other than the moral rightness of your character to govern the races that's being hinted at here and that I totally buy. I look forward to what's going to happen, but I still agree with a lot of what you've said here, Alan, and that there is room for improvement, and improving it would be to take Tolkien's worldview a little more seriously than they have, although they haven't discarded it entirely, I think. So,
fair, agreed.
Okay, we've been going for a long time, so we're going to make our rating segment pretty fast. We do three ratings, one for content, from celestial to terrestrial, celestial, outer darkness. So I would personally give this one celestial. I can't recall anything except for, oh no, there was the blood. The one battle one, yeah. Maybe I'm going to downgrade terrestrial.
Terrestrial here for the one content, for the violence. Everything else is celestial, but for the violence in episode 6, it was...
It's just that one episode.
Yeah, just that one episode. But it was gratuitous. It was extended. It lingered. It was worse than anything in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. It pushed the PG-13 boundaries beyond. I would say that if you were to give this a movie MPAA rating in the films, it would probably be a R for those scenes alone. So.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Terrestrial for me, overall. If they had just toned down a little bit of the violence, it's like a scene where he's like slowly digging a knife into an eye. I don't need to see that. Otherwise, though, I probably would have given this Celestial as well. There's no swearing, there's no sex, there's no, like, a, just aside from the stranger being naked because he just fell from the sky as a comet, there's nothing else really here.
Almost every other episode, I wouldn't mind my 7-year-old watching behind. Almost, not complete.
Nothing to add, agreed. On board.
All right, so artistic merit, we rate from 1 to 5 popcorn balls. I think we can't fault the visuals, obviously. Like, the money was well spent. It looks gorgeous. I think all of the effects get pulled off. The writing is maybe what takes it down a notch. What do you guys think on a scale of 1 to 5?
I'd give it 4 popcorn balls. The whole thing is gorgeous. I think, like Alan's complained about Numenor seeming like as big as his high school. The reason I disagree is because I love those visuals of this great civilization and this island here. Things like that. I, too, loved that last 7 minutes because it's all done through very subtle acting. I think the actors overall do a good job with the dialogue and the things they're given. The music is amazing. Bear McCreary, like, knocked out of the park. And I love the final song of the ring poem set to music that I think is just so haunting and makes a couple of interesting choices and in where the melody goes. But I like it. And so, yeah, 4.5 popcorn balls.
Yeah.
And again, just for the writing and not even all of it. Like, the Durin Elrond is, like, really, really good. And so I'm at 4, maybe 4.5 popcorn balls.
I'm totally at 5 because I just love the show. I understand people's critiques, but for me, my love of it just simply allowed me to ignore the faults. So I'm just going to give it 5.
Okay, Alan, be our dissenter.
Yeah, you can let me go first. You put the downer at the beginning and then end with the happy people. But I would give episode 4, or sorry, not 4, 8. The last episode, I would give like 4, 4.5 popcorn balls. I thought that was really pretty good. Like, I still have serious issues. We'll say 4. Episode 2, I would also put it like maybe 3.5, 4, something like that. And the rest of it, I'm hanging out around like 1.5. Like, I just thought the dialogue, like, I'm a words guy. And to me, like, the awfulness of so much of the language and the just the plotting and character and just all sorts of basic errors that just made it almost unwatchable to me.
Okay, we'll start with you again for Gospel Connections. How about that? We rate Gospel Connections on a scale of 1 to 5 apricots, morally edifying messages or things that cause us to think and have questions. What are your thoughts on that, Alan?
Hey, good. Negative. I'd say to me, I'm just not sure there's enough substance there for me to go higher than 3, but there's not bad stuff. And Jeff points out more good stuff than I had picked up on. So, you know, 3, 3.5.
I'd give it 4 if it had been a little truer to Tolkien's worldview and his understanding of the nature of evil and the reasons why people make the decisions they do and that leads to the consequences that they do. It would have been 5. It's not quite there, but there's some great discussion to be had about agency, as Jeff pointed out, friendship with Durin and Elrond, being overzealous, even in the cause of righteousness from Galadriel, greediness from the dwarves, and what's our obligation to other people. There was some good discussions. And so for me, 4 apricots, which again is what I give everything, is if there's an explicitly Christian connection, that's when I bump it up to 5. But that's just my own take on our rating system.
I'm going to give it 5, if only because everything you just said, Carl, but also there's almost the theological take on Lucifer, the Luciferian archetype there that kind of demonstrates how the episode works in our lives. So I think there are some the real genuine gospel connection there. I give it a 5 because I just don't know that much entertainment out there that has this deep moral texture. Now, it doesn't always get it right, but it's a deeply moral texture that I can learn from and grow from and showcase and write essays on and show my kids, here's how the adversary works, here's how moral agency works. I can't do that with most other shows. And so it stands head and shoulders above other shows for that reason. Even if there's room to nitpick, I still give it a 5 on that front.
So one of my frustrations through the first 7 episodes was this theme of sometimes you have to touch the darkness to be able to recognize the light. I forget the exact line, right? But it's like for the first 7 or so episodes, mostly I just thought, I don't know that they know what they mean by this. And in a couple of points, they seem to tread perilously close to, well, do something bad so that you'll know what good is, right? And say, hey, what are you saying? I'm not sure what you're saying. I'm not sure I like it. And then in the last episode, when Sauron is tempting her and he's appearing in the form of her brother and he says to her, touch the darkness again. Right. He turns this against her and turns it into this. Oh, you've touched the darkness to see the light before. Just do it again. It won't have any consequences. That moment, I thought, was a very artful and unexpected turning of what had appeared to be a previous message of the show against itself. in a way that I thought was very positive and wise. So that was a cool thing.
All right. Yep. Sounds good to me. Somewhere around 3 to 4. I'm a little less positive on it than Carl because I think they fumbled some of the stuff that they could have done a little better. I'll go with 3.5 for me. All right. That was a great discussion, guys. Sorry we went so long, but I think the show deserves it. I'm interested to see where it goes in the next few seasons. Alan, where can people find you, read stuff from you?
Deseret News and Public Square. I don't write a ton, but when I do, it's usually there.
Okay. And Jeffrey, where are you?
I blog at ldsphilosopher.com, but I haven't posted there in 3 years or so. Most of my writing is now in books or at Public Square as well.
Okay. And Carl?
I'm on Twitter at Carl Cranny, as long as Twitter is still around.
And you can follow my writing and book reviews at lizbusby.com. And with that, season one of our podcast is over. Carl and I will be taking a break for the Christmas holidays, so you can expect to hear more from us around late January. We thank all of you who have been listening. You're the reason we keep pouring our time into making this podcast. The best gift you could give us for Christmas would be to leave a review on the podcast platform of your choice, or better yet, share the podcast with someone who you know would love it. And we're excited to come back next year to keep exploring the gospel through great stories. This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. See you next time!